Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
A warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, together with my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Matt is a nationally recognized expert spokesperson on mental health and substance use disorder issues. He utilizes his experience and expertise to lead the Betty Ford Center's outpatient services as its director.
If you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and dealing with addictions, and so much more.
Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I'm excited to bring our guest today. It is Marvin D. Seppala, M.D. He is Chief Medical Officer at the Betty Ford Foundation and the Adjunct Assistant Professor at the Hazleton Betty Ford Graduate School of Addiction Studies.
His responsibilities include overseeing all interdisciplinary clinical practice at the foundation, maintaining and improving quality of care, and supporting growth strategies for Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation's residential and non-residential addiction treatment programs.
Dr. Seppala attained his MD at Mayo Medical School in Rochester, Minnesota, and served as residency in psychiatry and a fellowship in addiction at the University of Minnesota Hospitals in Minneapolis.
He's the author of Clinician's Guide to the 12-Step Principles and a co-author of When Painkillers Become Dangerous, Pain-Free Living for Drug-Free People, and Prescription Painkillers. Dr. Seppala, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Really glad to be here. Thanks a lot.
Well, it is great to have you, and as we prepared for this, we did a little bit of research, and one of the statistics was pretty shocking. So Dr. Seppala, we learned that drug overdose deaths as a whole have eclipsed car accident deaths to become the number one accidental cause of death. So tell us, what has fueled this dramatic increase in drug overdose deaths?
Yeah, the primary issue has been the overdose deaths associated with the painkiller medications, the opioids. So that would include things like Vicodin, oxycodone, and other medicines like that used for the treatment of moderate to severe pain. And it's increased, these overdose deaths have increased since the late 90s, and they resulted from an increase in the prescribing of these medications, in particular for chronic pain, and they don't work very well for chronic pain for most people. So it was an inappropriate use of the medication, but it became remarkably widespread, and with that, more and more people were using these medications and overdosing on them.
Now, full disclosure, Dr. Seppala and I have worked together at Hazleton Betty Ford, and I came to the organization about a year ago, and this kind of shift in our organization towards focusing on the opiate epidemic, was that due to this kind of overprescription situation?
Yeah, in general, I mean, there are a number of things that happened. We noticed kind of in the late 90s, early 2000s, that there was this change in prescribing pattern in regard to the opioid pain medications. And when you work in addiction, you know, when there's more prescribing of an addictive substance, there's going to be more addiction. It just goes hand in hand. And then that's what occurred. So there was increased prescribing, evidence of misuse of the medications. So they're prescribed, but people use them in alternative ways than how they're prescribed. Treatment admissions themselves started to escalate, and we noticed that in our own system, that more and more people were coming in, a higher frequency of people with opioid use disorders or opioid addiction. So There were also an increase in emergency room admissions for these overdose problems, as well as an increase in overdose deaths. So around the country, people working in addiction really became alarmed because of these deaths in particular. And on an internal basis, our system started to recognize more people with this problem. And as a result of that, rather than kind of entering our system and kind of getting involved in a positive way in the treatment programs and addressing their addiction in a real robust manner, they were kind of gathering together in a negative way and trying to figure out ways to bring, you know, opioids onto our campuses, into the outpatient programs, and figuring out ways to leave treatment early rather than really engaging positively in treatment. And that became a major issue. So we were getting early discharges. People weren't completing treatment, and that's a really bad predictor in regard to outcome. Most people who don't complete treatment don't do well. And we started to notice deaths after treatment when people relapsed on these opioids, which is unusual in the addiction field. When people relapse on alcohol, they don't usually die. Or when they relapse on cocaine, they don't usually die. But with these medications, once you've stopped for a few weeks, your tolerance to the medicine drops way down, in particular in regard to your breathing. And the overdose deaths are because people stop breathing. And so when their tolerance to the effects on the respiratory center in the brain that controls how we breathe, when that drops off and you use again at the kind of same dosage or same amount you were taking prior to treatment that you are really used to and getting high with, then suddenly it becomes a real dangerous amount and can kill you. And we saw that happen to some people, and it really got our attention because the last thing we want to see is people dying after treatment.
Well, of course. Now, Doctor, as a society or as a culture, what do you attribute these huge increases to?
In the prescribing of these medications?
Well, in the abuse of them more than, yes, in the prescribing, but also in the abused from the standpoint of the person actually taking them and or the abuse of the people that are writing the scripts.
Sure. You know, the increase in the prescribing was the result of a number of factors, but primarily there was a change in kind of the recognition of the use of these medications and a diminished recognition of their risk. So there was a minor paper that was published, actually just a letter to the editor from a really well-known pain physician who said that you could use these medications in people that have chronic pain and they don't get addicted to them. In fact, it's extremely unlikely they'd get addicted to them. And that was absolutely false. As it turns out, people with chronic pain are highly likely to become addicted to these medications. And so there was a shift also in how physicians view the treatment of pain, where we absolutely were not adequately addressing pain. And so there was some real good in this kind of reexamination of pain treatment. But, you know, like many things, the pendulum swung way too far, and physicians started prescribing way too much in the way of opioids, and they became very easy to access. And in fact, often in major medical systems, physicians are graded by patients after their visits or after their interactions, and one of the grades is often, you know, how is your pain taken care of? So for a physician to take care of pain, it's real easy to write a prescription for a strong, powerful pain medication. And if they do that, everybody's happy. The patient's gone and they've got a prescription. They're happy. They've got what they want and their pain may be treated. And initially that works well, but over time it doesn't. And if you're being graded every time patients come in on how pain's being treated, then you're highly likely to do the things to eliminate that pain, whether it's the right decision or not.
Now, who's doing this grading?
It's actually the patients themselves, and they're, you know, they send them into the healthcare system, whichever system the person's involved in, And if the physicians, you know, let's say someone's interested in one of these medications, whether legitimately or illegitimately, and the physician refuses to provide it, then they write a survey. They fill out their survey and they say, I don't like this physician. He doesn't give me what I want for my pain. And sometimes, often actually, physician salaries are altered by how these surveys go on an annual basis. So there's a lot of strange incentives in this.
Well, yeah, but it sounds a little bit like, you know, the inmates running the asylum. I mean, you can't have everybody on that level making the decisions. The idea is that the doctor is the person who's gone to school for 8 years that's supposed to have the knowledge to know if they should have this or not. And I think if we allowed every patient to decide what they want, you know what? I want a new jacuzzi. You know, I want a massage every day, and I want you to prescribe it. So, you know. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, it's really been trouble, and a lot of partially because this the paper that I mentioned that revealed the safety of these medicines for chronic pain that wasn't even accurate actually got a lot of play. And then it was supported by the pharmaceutical industry, who is manufacturing and selling these powerful pain medications, who said, yeah, look at this. You know, these things are safe for people. They won't get addicted. And a lot of training around the country took place suggesting safety when actually there was really high risk. And so we got into a really bad situation in which physicians drop their guard in regard to the risk associated with this type of medication and started to prescribe them, you know, just like they would, you know, some of the safer pain medications that are not opioid related and not addicting.
You know, and when we're looking at the physicians and the training involved with people prescribing a lot of these opiate medications, when I was doing some research, I was actually shocked at the limited amount of education. I mean, I remember when I went through my doctorate program, I think there was a semester, and most MFTs and, you know, addiction, you know, not addiction counselors, but most, you know, professional degrees don't involve that much education. And have you noticed similar with the medical field, Marv or Dr. Cepola?
Yeah, absolutely. And I go by Marv. So there's a tremendous lack of education in all aspects of medicine and mental health in regard to addiction. We just don't do an adequate job of training our students. So in screening of addiction, recognition of addiction, the interventions, the treatment that can be used for addiction, it's lacking in medical schools. In fact, in medical school, on average, it's less than one day throughout the 4 years of medical school that is devoted to addiction training, less than one day. And when the Affordable Care Act was written, there was a recognition by the federal government that addiction actually affected 25% of the healthcare budget. And so 25% of the healthcare budget is being, you know, affected by a disease, addiction, that's taught for one day in most medical schools. Doesn't make any sense. Nursing schools don't train. You know, as you said, Matt, psychologist programs don't address addiction. Social work, mental health master's programs don't address addiction. So we're really missing the boat. We're not training the groups of folks that would be most likely to be able to recognize and intervene on this problem.
And do you see, you know, someone stepping in? I mean, we're with all the kind of TMZ social media knowledge of what's going on with the princes of the world and these Narcan shots. Do you see someone stepping in mandating more education?
Absolutely. You know, I actually was in Washington, D.C. last week meeting with folks from the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Addiction Medicine Foundation, which is a part of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. We were meeting at the offices of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. There's a representative from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and our focus was establishing an upcoming symposium, a national symposium at the White House to address academic medical centers and how they could become centers of excellence in addiction medicine. So there's a real opportunity right now, and I believe the opportunity unfortunately, it's the result of this tragedy, these opioid overdoses. People in the federal government and elsewhere are recognizing this is a true crisis, and we have to really do a lot about it, but there's a real impetus to begin to do something, and it's happening in our medical education systems.
Now, Doctor, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act. How do you think that that has or will affect the treatment industry?
I'm really happy about the Affordable Care Act because that statistic I mentioned, that 25% of healthcare budgets affected by addiction, resulted in prioritizing within that act the treatment of addiction for the first time by the federal government. So addiction was recognized as an illness that absolutely requires attention throughout our healthcare systems. And so there will be increased access to treatment for people who otherwise would have gone without treatment in the past. This is a tremendous thing. And it's primarily going to be on an outpatient basis. There's still going to be a lot of residential treatment as well, but for the most part, people will be able to access outpatient treatment. And I think because of this, there's going to be some of these, the treatment programs that really work in inner cities and work with, in the past, people that had no insurance and were either on Medicare or, state funding or no funding, and they were just doing it to help these folks. Those people will primarily have insurance now, resulting in, revenue for these programs that they never had before, and they can improve upon the treatment that they offer as a result, because in the past they've just been barely getting by trying to, provide good care for folks that had no insurance. So I think a lot of good is going to come of this.
And it sounds like, recognizing it as a chronic disorder turns it, my problem in the field of psychology is we're a softer science. And so without good empirically validated studies and research, it's hard for us to become a hardened science. But it sounds like we're finally recognizing, addiction in general as a chronic disease, and hopefully the treatment will follow.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. The American Medical Association defined addiction as an illness back in the 50s, and yet if physician surveys show that a lot of physicians still don't believe that, and now we have a real neurobiological basis for addiction as disease. Recently, kind of documented in summary by the head of the National Institute of Drug Abuse and the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And so this kind of information being nailed down will really help, because it'll get more people's attention that this is a disease and not just a, problem of will or morals, that this is a disease that needs the attention that it's due.
Now, Doctor, and when we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, we have seen some changes, and as I put my investigator hat on, the other side of me looking at this has become aware that, unfortunately, there are addiction treatment companies that have some shady practices, and I think we've all heard of those, like paying for referrals or excessive charges for lab tests, literally, buying and selling patients. What can we do about this? You mentioned earlier about a pendulum, and on the one hand, it's good that we are opening up the doors and getting more people to get treatment. On the other hand, how do we combat that part of it so that the pendulum doesn't swing back and a lot of doors end up getting closed?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that the increased potential for profit as a result of the Affordable Care Act will result in a lot more shady practices and programs showing up in this field. Unfortunately, it's kind of been fraught with that throughout its existence, where there's some really solid players, and most are, absolutely, that don't do these things. But then, because there's more profit potential, it brings the possibility of these programs that really don't follow ethical practice. And we've seen exactly what you've described, paying for referrals, paying for patients to come to your program, It's getting attention nationally now. I've seen some descriptions in newspapers and magazines in the media about these practices. And at least in Florida right now, the Attorney General is going after some of these practices. And I think when patients and families, when anyone working in this field is aware of these issues in a program, that they should report it to that state attorney general, because in the rest of medicine, although this goes on to a degree, it's really minor compared to the addiction field, and it brings everybody down. Every program in the addiction field is affected when one program is doing these shady practices and gets caught, because people who need help, you know, are vulnerable. They seek out a place that's doing these sorts of shady things and don't provide good treatment. And then their opinion and the opinions that they share with others could be that, you know, you can't trust these people, you can't get good treatment. And so we have to put an end to these sorts of things. And they're, unfortunately, really commonplace in Southern California, in Florida, somewhat in Texas. And the two major issues are paying people for referrals. So since we're, practitioners, mental health and medical practitioners in private practice, you could get paid for sending your patients to a certain program. Or I've even just recently read about programs that send people to meet patients that are in a particular treatment program, perhaps at a 12-step meeting or a coffee shop or something, and they convince them to relapse in order to come enter a different program.
Wow.
Now that's as bad as it gets.
Wow.
It's hard to imagine such a thing, but it's going on, because you know, if you can get them into your program and it's legitimate because they just relapsed, then you can make a bunch of money on this. And then the drug screening situation is really problematic, in that you can do some really good urine drug screening testing to see if someone's still using drugs or not for $100 or less. I mean, very easily and effectively. But some of these programs were testing people 5, 6, 7 times a week and charging above $1,000, $1,200 per test. And then the patient's insurance or their family would get stuck with this enormous bill after a month of this, and they were making up for any losses they had otherwise in their treatment programs by overcharging in a really fraudulent manner for these urine drug tests. And it goes on around the country, unfortunately, really commonly right now.
You know, and we have a lot of great listeners out there that are teachers, mental health professionals, and parents. And so when I'm listening to you, it seems like it becomes very difficult to find programs and services. And so if you were to be looking as an outsider, what criteria would be important to you?
You know, I'd want to know that the program is licensed with the state that they're in, that they're in good standing with the state, that all of their professionals that work there are in good standing with their licensing boards and professional organizations. I think there's a national group, the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. I would want to be sure that the program was involved with that group. They're really bringing attention to these fraudulent practices and trying to influence their members to make changes and really support high-quality programs that don't do such things. So that's how I'd start looking. I'd want to know that the treatment personnel at the program had been around for a while, you know, that they aren't changing counselors and psychologists and physicians every, you know, several months or once a year, that they've actually got a fairly stable staff. That's a good sign.
All right, we're going to take a break. We are talking with Dr. Marvin Seppala. And for those of you, if you'd like to follow along and you're at a computer, open up another window to www.hazeltonbettyford.org. You can open up another window. You can kind of follow along with some of the things that we're doing. Obviously, if you're driving, don't try this, but stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
We're back with our guest, Dr. Marv Seppala. Dr. Seppala, I'd love to shift our focus to the treatment side, and you being kind of on the cutting edge of all the treatment work, there's a listener question that came in, and it says, I suspected that my 15-year-old niece is using hard drugs, and my sister, a single mother, is afraid she will run away if she pushes her. Before I give any advice, I need to be more certain about the physical signs of this addiction and what my sister's options might be. Can you give some direction on how you'd proceed?
So really wanting to be sure that there is drug use. You know, one thing is that for the most part, we tend to find out fairly late in drug use that it's actually occurring in families, because you know, most kids know how to hide this stuff, and if it's starting to show up in an obvious manner, it's highly likely that a problem exists. Maybe it isn't addiction, maybe it's still experimental use, but that is a problem, especially if they're, you know, quote, hard drugs, unquote. So with the opioids, when people are using them, their pupils are really pinpoint. They're very, very small, so that's an easy thing to notice, an easy thing to see, and it would go along with other evidence of intoxication, that they might be extremely tired, they might, you know, be uninterested in the usual things they used to do or be interested in, including school and family activities. So those sorts of changes in behavior really should get one's attention. With the injectable drugs, of course, injection sites, that kind of thing, where someone would be injecting themselves could be found, or even just the paraphernalia used by people to smoke the drugs or needles and syringes, that sort of thing.
And basically, you know, professionals listening in are familiar with the 12-step programs and the 12-step approach to recovery. But we're starting evolving into some different medication, you know, medication-assisted treatments. Will you share a little on that?
Sure, be glad to. So medications are now available for treatment of alcoholism and alcohol use disorders, as well as for opioid use disorders. We don't have medicines for a lot of the other types of addiction, but we do for these two. And they're somewhat effective for alcoholism. They're very effective for the opioid use disorders. You know, people have certainly heard of methadone. It's been around since the mid to late 60s and used for primarily initially heroin addiction, but now also used for these prescription opioids. But it's being replaced more and more by a medicine, buprenorphine, commonly called Suboxone, and you take it every day. It is a partial opioid, so it's like the opioids people are using. It can be abused, so there has to be some care taken with it, people need a whole treatment program, not just the medication. And then there's a third medicine, extended-release naltrexone. Naltrexone cannot be abused. It doesn't provide any kind of intoxication. It blocks the effects of these opioids, of these pain medications and heroin. So if people are taking naltrexone, they can't get high. In some respects, it's a perfect solution. The problem is people stop taking it, of course, and then just go get high. So the key is medication adherence, keeping people engaged, involved on the medication, and addressing all the other issues associated with addiction treatment. As described, we have a real 12-step abstinence-based approach to treatment, but we also use evidence-based psychotherapies like cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement therapies for the treatment of addiction, and we combine all of that, the 12-step program, the psychotherapies with medication, in an attempt to get the best possible outcomes for the people that come to us for help.
Now, see, that makes perfect sense, because essentially it says to me that you're taking each patient individually and not trying to put everybody in one category, and I like that. But in terms of these practices, do you see different treatment programs attempting to carve out their own specific territory and maybe shying away from working with new or different modalities?
Yeah, we certainly do. Some programs are actually advertising and stating that they don't use any of these medications, as if that would be a better choice. And there is certainly some controversy about the use of buprenorphine or Suboxone, and I think that's their primary gripe, that they don't want to provide people that type of medication, I think primarily because of a bias about the potential for abuse of that medication, and when they're not used correctly, when they're not supported correctly by the physician and the staff that are overseeing the program, they can be problematic. But when done right, they can really be helpful. They engage more people in treatment. They stay longer in treatment, which is going to result in better outcomes. And in our setting, we try and get people off the medication after they're really solid in long-term recovery. And that's the best of both worlds. We're using the medicine to engage people, get them into treatment, get them into good recovery, and then take them off these medications. I've even seen some programs, to really answer your question, that have, they've specialized in detoxing people from Suboxone. So they see it as a bad thing that people take this medication somehow, and they want to help them get off it. And it can be difficult to get off that medication ultimately, but with a lot of support, with good recovery, it's not that tough.
And luckily I've had the chance to see you be instrumental in redefining this opioid addiction care with this model. And do you feel, after time and it becomes more and more empirically validated, that it'll become more of a universal application?
I do. I think slowly but surely it's going to get there, and I've seen that happen. I gave a talk at the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers 3 years ago about our program, using this combination of the 12-step psychotherapies and these medications for opioid use disorders. And half the group in the audience really thought we were making a big mistake, and the other half thought we were going down the right path. It was really a mixed group, and the folks who didn't agree with what we were doing were fairly vocal about that. And actually, publicly, outside of that talk, we were really criticized for our decision to go down that path with medication. But I was back at the same conference last spring, and a lot more people were positive about the use of this medication, a lot more treatment programs. And I've seen that during the interim, where we've had a lot of contact from treatment programs asking about how we've done this, how it's working. We're doing a research project on it that we don't have the results yet, but we have really good early data that supports positive outcomes. We published a manual about it, and it sold very well. Other programs and medical clinics really want to do this and do it right. And it answers a lot of questions to be able to combine the types of therapies that people are really used to using already that have been shown to be effective for the treatment of addiction, combining that with these medications really lends the possibility that more people are going to get better, more people get sober, more people get into recovery and do well. And to me, that's kind of hard to argue with.
Now, Doctor, what I hear you saying is this sort of a knee-jerk reaction to the people that don't want to utilize one drug to get somebody off of something else is sort of a, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, type of situation, to where because there's problems now with some other drugs that they want to just go, okay, we're just going to stop on all of them? Is that kind of the problem?
I think there is that, and I think there's also just kind of people making decisions based on their own sort of perspective or their own experience without really looking at the medical literature and trying to learn, you know, about the successes and the problems associated with the use of medications in the treatment of addiction. And, you know, the science is advancing. We're learning more and more about the neurobiology of addiction, more and more about the potential for medications to help people initiate recovery and get sober and to stay sober, you know. So we think that if we can use a medication, fantastic. Some of these programs and some of the people running them, you know, they got sober in a certain manner, and they just kind of think everybody has to do it in the same manner, and that's their bias. And unfortunately, that's a very narrow way of examining the treatment of any illness.
I was talking with a good friend of mine, and we were discussing how in our, you know, clinic and program, all different types of people come in, and we're seeing a lot of professionals come in, and she had said something along the lines of, you know, addiction doesn't discriminate. And I agree, and I know that one of your focuses is working with healthcare professionals, and I think you had said it's an occupational hazard, actually, addiction. And so what I was curious is do you have specific specialized treatment in the need for these healthcare professionals, you know, who are really in crisis?
You know, we do. The reason I call it an occupational hazard is that exposure is a risk factor for addiction, and exposure in the workplace for physicians, for nurses, for even technicians that have to deal with these medicines daily can result in use. And these are really powerful medications, so the potential for addiction exists. Even, you know, just to make this point that one of my mentors during my residency training, Joe Westermeyer, he did some work in Southeast Asia during and after the Vietnam War looking at opium addiction itself. And the Hmong people in Southeast Asia grow the opium. And basically, they had really high rates of opium addiction among their tribes. And when you got to the closer cities around them, the rate of opium addiction went down. And when you got to the major cities, it went down even further, even among the Hmong culture. So that basically just having exposure is a risk factor. So if you grow up in a part of a major city in the United States where there's a lot of drug use and a lot of drug dealers, you're exposed on a regular basis, you're more likely to use, and as a result, more likely to become addicted. And the same is true for healthcare professionals. When we look at anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists, they're the ones providing the most powerful drugs on the planet to our patients, and they're the ones with the highest risk associated with addiction as a result. So I do see it as an occupational hazard. And it's also extremely problematic for a healthcare professional to become addicted. They have incredible guilt and shame in regard to what they're doing, especially if they're gathering their medications in the workplace by theft. That's often called diversion in a medical setting, but it's basically just theft. They're diverting the medicine for personal use that's supposed to go to a patient, so that's why it gets that name. However, it's a major problem, and we've established treatment programs both at Betty Ford Center up in Oregon, at Hazel and Springbrook, and in Minnesota at Hazel and Center City for healthcare professionals, because this group really needs other people in the same kind of work setting to help them out to realize the problem and to move into recovery. So when we provide groups that have, you know, 10 doctors and 10 nurses all addressing this issue together, that guilt and shame that kind of keeps them from even admitting they have a problem starts to be exposed, because often a healthcare professional starts to think they're the only one that's ever, you know, stolen a medication at work or injected themselves at work. And because it goes so against their normal, you know, workplace expectations, they can't admit it to anyone, and often they can't even admit it to themselves. So when they walk into a group, somebody new, and there's all these other people talking about doing the same sort of things they were doing, it just lessens this problem, releases some of that shame and guilt, and allows people to really start talking about what's going on and expressing the truth about their situation.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point, because for somebody in a normal job, if they were to start to have a problem with a particular drug, they might be able to get help. They might be able to talk to their friends or whatever. But it's different, because if you're there and you're amongst the same people, I think you believe, okay, I'm going to lose the job, I'm going to lose their respect, I'm going to lose so much more. So again, I think you bring up a great point as to why a lot of people would not want to seek help in that situation. Now, I want to share, we have another listener question, and again, I want to thank the people that take the time. I know that everybody can't listen. I was speaking to a teacher recently at the gym that said that, you know, she listens through iTunes because the show happens to be right in the middle of the day when she is teaching. So for those that take the time to send us a question, I want you to know that it is appreciated. This one reads, in reading the piece about this show on the Answers for the Family site, I was shocked to learn that individuals who relapse are at a higher risk of dying from an overdose. Doctor, how does your program address this risk in your treatment protocols?
You know, right from the onset of treatment, when people enter our programs, whether they're in an outpatient setting or a residential setting, we talk about this risk and try to inform people. And then on a weekly basis, we remind them of this risk and the potential for overdose and death. So every group that we have specific to these medications, which is at least weekly, they start out with a warning, so that we hope by repetition, people start to recognize the risk. Now, we also do it individually with people. And if they're in our programs, they're being told all about the use of medications that could help their addiction. And in that discussion, there's also going to be the discussion about risk in terms of relapse. So it's a fairly consistent communication that we've used as a strategy to address the risk in our treatment protocols. But also the medications themselves, both Suboxone, the buprenorphine, and the extended-release naltrexone have been proven to reduce the risk of overdose death. So when you have people that are on these medications, it's going to be a little less likely that they could die of an overdose, primarily because they're a lot less likely to use again. The relapse risk has dropped significantly. But we also inform people about how this works. And as I mentioned earlier, when people stop opioids, when they begin opioids, when people begin to use these medications, they're really powerful, and tolerance develops really rapidly, so they need more and more and more to get the same high or the same pain relief, the same benefit they're seeking, that they have to use more and more to get there over a brief period of time. And as a result, their body and their brain is accommodating to that medication. And we call it tolerance. And then when they stop using, so they're in treatment for a few weeks, maybe a few months, they've discontinued the medication, life's going a lot better, they're feeling better. The truth is their brain and their body is doing the opposite then. It's losing that tolerance, so that if they relapse, and most people when they relapse, they want to get intoxicated. They want to use the same amount they used to use. They don't take into account this risk. So that's why our strategy has been, you know, to really repeatedly bring up this risk and try and convince them of this risk. So that at that point, when they're making that decision, or when it's made for them, that they've just kind of fallen right back into relapse without really thinking it through, they would at least think, you know, I'd better be careful. This could be extremely dangerous.
And to kind of piggyback on that, you know, if it were to happen, we have emergency medications such as Narcan. And so if we've kind of, as a, you know, culture, accepted that we have an epidemic, and for those listeners who aren't familiar, Narcan is the medicine, the injectable medicine that is, quote, a lifesaver or can help prevent that overdose. Dr. Seppala, I'm curious, as far as availability of Narcan, where would you like to see that grow, and where would you like to see, you know, it become more and more available?
You know, we provide Narcan, this antidote for an opioid overdose, to every patient that has an opioid use disorder that comes into our system. And where we also are just now starting a protocol that'll get it to every family of that patient, so that in case there's an overdose, the potential exists to save that person's life. I've also seen several states that have asked for a couple physicians in the state to provide prescriptions that are available for people with opioid use disorders, so they could just walk into a pharmacy and get a prescription instead of seeking it from a physician. Certain pharmacies around the country, I think CVS and Walgreens, have set up such programs in different states, which is just remarkable. The medicine's becoming increasingly available, and I want to see that go further, because it's a fairly innocuous substance. Otherwise, if you don't have an opioid overdose and someone gives you this medicine, nothing's going to happen, and it only lasts for a brief period of time, which is good and bad, because some people have taken so much of a opioid and overdose that they might need more than one dosage of this medication to prevent the overdose and allow them to avoid death.
Now, is that something that is also used from the standpoint of when they're starting to detox? I know that we just picked somebody up from a local jail, and he said that he was given that as soon as he went in. So I was wondering if the purpose was that they were concerned that he might have just used prior to that, or if they were also trying to use it so that it would help him detox.
You know, it should only be used for emergency purposes when people have overdosed. However, I mean, Narcan's, the medicine name itself is naloxone, and it's very similar to naltrexone, which is used for the treatment of opioid use disorders. So sometimes those systems will provide people the naltrexone. And there's rarely use of Narcan or naloxone to kind of give a person to be sure they're not using and that they're safe for provision of other medications like the naltrexone, which is longer lasting.
Okay. Now, now, given the whole prescription painkiller epidemic, let's talk about training. I mean, you know, is more training for physicians the way to go? More training for other clinicians about addiction or addict behavior? You know, what would kind of be the next step at this point from an education standpoint?
You know, we want to see training in all medical schools, in all nursing schools, psychology programs, social work programs, mental health master's programs, and we've really devoted resources to this. We've got a summer institute for medical students at Betty Ford Center and our Center City campus in Minnesota, where that's completely covered by charitable donations for medical students to come in for a week of training and experience in the treatment of addiction. We also provide a professional in residence program that's available to physicians, to judges, attorneys, clergy, anyone who's a professional that engages with people that have addiction and wants to learn more about it could come in for a week-long program in any of our residential settings. We provide rotations for medical residents, so those residents who are training in a specialty to come in, like especially family practice and internal medicine, to learn more about addiction. We provide rotations for addiction fellows in several different medical schools in the country. And at Betty Ford Center, we have our own addiction fellowship where a fellow will stay for 1 year to really specialize in addiction after their residency training so they can move on to be an expert in the addiction field. We also have a curriculum that we can provide to medical schools that's called CARE, C-A-R-E, that's actually can be just inserted into their medical school experience and provide training in addiction. So there's a lot of possibilities, but the main thing is to get into the curriculum of all these schools for all these different mental health providers and for physicians in medical school, enough training about addiction that they start to recognize it, intervene on it, and refer people for addiction treatment.
Well, Doctor, I want to thank you. Time has flown by. This has been an incredibly educating experience, I think, for everybody. And I just want to thank you. I want to really acknowledge what you've done and what Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation has done as they continue to be a trailblazer, in the training nationwide, of all of us, helping all of us learn more about what this is and how we can serve the people better. So again, I want to thank you. I want to acknowledge you, and would love to have you back anytime you're available.
I'd be glad to. I appreciate the opportunity.
And please tune in next week when we'll replay one of our most popular health shows of 2016 with leading peripheral nerve surgeon Dr. Richard Jacoby, featuring his new best-selling book, The Sugar Crush: Why Sugar Crush is Slowly Killing You and How to Stop It, and the Link Between Sugar and Alzheimer's, Cancer, Autism, and More. If you've missed a show or you want to share our show with your friends and family, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word.
All right. For everybody out there, have a great week. Be good humans and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.